Today's episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. You can get even more of the true crime that's worth your time, or not, at bestevidence.fyi. And now, the episode.
It was a total immersion into the life of a mafia household, so I never heard so many creative uses of the F word in my life.
Challenge accepted, FBI lady. The title sounds like a video game, but we decided to talk about Fear City, New York versus the Mafia, because Bart Layton of American Animals and The Imposter executive produced the project. Is Fear City Layton-ish? If so, is that a good thing? And can I get this Giuliani Botox analogy to work? Speaking of things with good intentions that make no goddamn sense, the Cold Case section will confront a perfect murder episode on the murder of Gavin Smith, in which the only thing more baffling than Smith's disappearance is every single thing about the show. Throw on a TVPD crop top, it's The Blotter Presents, episode 152. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. My guest today is probably wondering what kind of PsyOps AV Club torture experiment I've been conducting on him lately. It is my Quaid in Full co-host and editor, Jeb Lund. Hello again, Jeb.
Finally, to not do Quaid, to go into the real world.
Quaid free. Unquaided?
Yeah.
I think it's unquaided. I'm gonna take the W. Let's do this. All right, our most wanted section. So, Fear City: New York versus the Mafia. That's on Netflix. It dropped last week. Here's the case file from Brian Tallarico's review at RogerEbert.com. Quote. Netflix's three-part miniseries Fear City is the story of what was known as the Commission Case, a landmark prosecution case in New York City in the 1980s that essentially dismantled the criminal empire of the mafia in this country, end quote. Not 100 on that part, but okay. Early badge humper chyrons and extended use of Curtis Sliwa made for something of a rocky start, in my opinion, but the three-part series found a groove pretty quickly, and it is processy as hell. Here is where I will drop a content warning. The local tabloids back in the day had zero compunction about running pictures of shot-up gangsters, and neither does Fear City, so it can get a little gory. Some of these guys were assassinated through the eye. Just be aware if you decide to watch this. So, Jeb, you agreed to sign on to this because you're a nice person and willing to help me out, but also because Bart Layton was one of the executive producers. He did American Animals, which we talked about and we liked. How were you feeling about this overall? Did you like it? Did it feel Layton-y to you? What were your thoughts?
It didn't feel Layton-y, but I wonder if that might just be my sample size, and because what we saw before was such a unique property that was doing something I haven't seen replicated really to that degree anywhere else. So like the specialness of that, it's kind of hard to see this, which is a more conventional presentation and say like, well, that's where that guy had his mark on it. But I enjoyed it. And I was talking to you off mic, like I have some of the listeners to our other podcast might've heard me talk about like getting either a labrum or a rotator cuff tear at the start of the pandemic, and then just having that worsened every day by having a 5-year-old try and twist my arm out of its socket while we play. And that knocks me out. So like on the weekend, I make all that pain up by like sleeping for an entire day. And I lay down on the couch and watched this and went through all three episodes without falling asleep. But the minute it was over, I was out for like 3 hours.
You're like, okay, the good guys won, we guess. Now I can sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I really liked this. There were a couple of things that I thought of as sort of not signature, but like an interesting way of doing a true crime series trope that felt like it had Bart Layton's fingerprints on it. Like there's one point at which a guy who's reenacting one of these ops to get a bug into a mafia household by pretending to be the cable guy. He, like, the reenactor is lip syncing the actual guy's voiceover, which I thought was kind of like kind of cool, good workaround. Instead of having the voiceover in this very silent movie acting, which they sort of also do, but they came up with ways to keep that fresh, I thought. And they got pretty good access, I thought, to case figures. Michael Francis, I have been seated next to at a press event, and I'm actually going to...
No kidding.
Skip ahead to Curtis Sliwa talking about the cologne that they're like flea dipped in because, oh my God, like, I don't know how Francis ever snuck up on anybody because the Drakkar was like half a block ahead of him. Anyway, here is clip three.
You know how I would spot the wise guys? Mm-hmm. Well, particularly in the disco era, mm-hmm. they had the polyester waffle weave bell bottoms. They had the open neck, you know, they had to have the hair. Ooh. Then they'd have that turlet water on, you know, like that Old Spice or High Karate.
I like water.
Man, you light a match, we'd all be blown to kingdom come.
I mean, you know, Disco Inferno's a little cheap, but made me laugh.
Look, turlet water buys so much goodwill that you could have ended it with, like, you know, loving my tummy, and you'd be like, all right, the turlet water.
I mean, it's funny because it's true. Meanwhile, the guy in the background of that clip is his barber, who is valiantly trying to cut Curtis Sliwa's hair during these talking heads, and Sliwa's like a, you know, big, like his storytelling is big, and one of our listeners on Twitter was like, please tell me you're going to talk about the fact that Curtis Sliwa almost got his throat slit like 15 times by this guy who's just trying to even up the sides. So
that was riveting. That was so my dad, this is not a long story. My dad cut half my earlobe off when I was like four, when he was trying to give me a haircut and I was fidgety. It grew back. I mean, like it does at that age, but I was watching that with like, the pain of experience, just like, oh my God, what happens now?
It's funny that the pain of my experience was like having marinated, like, I don't know, like, I'm from Jersey. These are my people. Like, I'm used to sort of like walking through certain diners and then you just have whatever high karate in your hair for the rest of the day. Like, fine. And then yours is, you know, non-lethal injuries suffered as a, you know, in pre-K. So this says something for everyone, I would say.
It's like everybody's going to have their own bloodthirsty experience.
Yeah. Sliwa is, I think, not universally well-received. Like, it does seem like in any miniseries about New York at a certain time in its life, he appears like the Maloik, but he has a certain way of putting things that this next clip is maybe 2 minutes into the first episode, and it kind of got me on this series aside immediately. So here is clip two.
The poor guy worked 6 days a week to pay it back. Meantime, I'd see these wise guys come in from the Bonanno crime family, bulls. And my uncle was in the back, and he would be schmitzing. He would be sweating because they'd be threatening him. They threatened his son, Joey Jr. They threatened my aunt and Lucy. And actually, they look at me and say, who's the kid, right? And they say, well, no, he's just a delivery boy. But man, that was frightening days. You knew when you borrowed money from them, if you didn't pay on time, they'd bend your leg and stuff it in your pocket.
I mean, what a way to put that. That's exactly it. Also, thank you for specifying that it was your Aunt Lucy, or your Aunt Lucy and not your other aunt. Like, that's just such a weird thing.
There's actually all of this series kind of brings up like a local flavor that, I mean, like local flavor in New York, everybody in the country knows it, but just the idea of having this like deeply idiomatic, not necessarily like ghettoized experience. Although, like, obviously, you know, where the mafia comes from is from Italian-American ghettos, right? But like these intense neighborhoods where you get this like, you know, this thick manner of speech and this idiom that I think is being washed out by the fact that like now we all kind of broadcast ourselves and we're all kind of like flattening toward that mid-Pacific accent. But like just to hear this, I mean, like, you know, I was going to get to this as like a bigger point, but like all of this is almost like almost everything else I've seen during the pandemic, kind of like a visual meal. I mean, it's not in the order of like watching Bride's Head Revisited where you're like, can I have 12 courses of imagery, please? But like hearing people from somewhere else, like hearing people from a different neighborhood that you can experience and then seeing like these rich images that are, you know, historical, but they're another place, like that was very transporting. And I really enjoyed that part of it.
So did I, because the place that I was being transported to was functionally here. Like, I live in Bay Ridge, but I grew up in this area and was sentient at this time, like the late 70s, not really. But by the time the commission case was happening, like there were certain people locally that were on your TV every night if you were a TV news household, which it was the past. So it was a matter of picking a channel. And so, yeah. Like, there's Chuck Scarborough looking about 12 years old. Like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. Giuliani was on the TV. Al Sharpton was on the TV every night. Like, these were the cases that were just, like, running a ticker under your consciousness all the time, even if you were, you know, remote from it in New Jersey, because the city was a disaster in the 70s, and your parents moved to the safety of the Garden State to have you and your sibling. So this was familiar, and there is something about mafia stories of the latter half of the 20th century that is not comforting to me, but I think this series understands that people like me, like, we understand that the mafia is bad and they're criminals and they had a deleterious effect on the social fabric of the city, or they were one thing that frayed that fabric, but that there is a familiarity about it. And part of this is just being from Jersey and being like, well, but it's my pork roll, egg and cheese, and you don't get to make fun of it. So
no, I mean, I'm a few years behind you, just a couple, and I was on the opposite coast, but I remember quite a bit of this coming through. I mean, I could recognize Al Sharpton. I knew who Al D'Amato was, but probably not one of my senators, you know, like the, right. Just because of the media dominance. So like there was definitely a nostalgic aspect of it, even for me. But one of the things I kept thinking about, actually, though, what you brought up, like, well, they don't, you know, feel the need to underline these are bad people. They do. They enforce it a couple times. Like they're like, by the way, these people are psychopaths. They're incredibly violent. And if the images don't do that for you, you know, like having people remind you of that will. But like it reminded me especially of John D. McDonald, the guy who wrote Cape Fear, wrote a series of novels about a Florida detective. It's basically the Florida detective story. Uh-huh. Carl Hiaasen and Tim Dorsey are in many ways scuttling out from under John D.'s overcoat. But one of the refrains that Travis McGee, his investigator hero in these books, has is he repeatedly brings up like how much he fucking hates The Godfather. And he's like, you didn't buy any of that stupid shit, did you? Like about it being about dignity and honor. These people are meatheads. Like they're meatheads and they're animals. And that is one of the things I always enjoy about like the post-50s, like the post-Kefauver hearings, mafia stories of New York, because there isn't that kind of gilding of a culture coming out of the ghetto and becoming, you know, a dominant force in the city. Like all the kind of fairy tale aspects of it are melted away. And it's just like, these are brutal and awful people.
Yeah.
You know, they're colorful, but they're brutal.
Yeah. Fighting for the right to racketeer. And
to commit domestic terror.
Yeah. I mean, and post Sopranos, like, I think the Chirons at the beginning of this series want us to think that the mafia was really behind much more of the city burning and like the warriors. It's a documentary. Like, all right, everybody just like calm down. It didn't actually implode. But there has been, I think, post Sopranos a tendency to I don't know, want to pick and choose the parts of that milieu and that idiom and all that stuff that are like kind of cool, rat pack, rat-a-tat. No one's really getting hurt. And it's like a style choice. And you can't, like, you know, you see these photos of a guy who's like drenched in blood holding a playing card. And you're like, well, first of all, get me rewrite because that's a little on the nose. But second of all, yikes. So I thought the series did a good job staying up on a tightrope because there's that aspect of it. But there's also like, now that everybody's really aware of propaganda and how law enforcement tends to influence any narrative that it has agreed to participate in, this seemed to have a good balance. So right. I guess it's time to talk about Giuliani. I was saying this to you the other day, like on our Quaid and Full Slack, I think, but there is a timeline. And I remember thinking about this at while watching The Property, for which I was at the press event, sitting next to Michael Franzese and eating, frankly, some really terrible veal scallopini, that there is a timeline in which Giuliani is just Selwyn Robb, who wrote The Five Families, which is like the basically the dictionary of the New York Mafia. He's the Selwyn Robb of the 21st century. And instead of doing whatever crypt keeper fascist cosplay is his current life, all he does is just go on like CNBC shows about extortion and the mafia. And he's their expert because he really knows a lot. And he presented as completely sane during this, which it's been a while since I didn't think that he was actively having a neurological bleed in front of us.
Well, I mean, we don't know. He could have been butt dialing a reporter, like literally as these scenes were taking place, like somewhere in New York, Olivia Nutzi's phone was ringing again.
Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I don't enjoy contemplating his butt even in a vernacular sense, but you're absolutely, correct. I'm going to play a clip in which he does a good job refocusing us on how not just tacky and sweary, but also lethally meat-headed these individuals were. Here's clip four.
Police in New Jersey say the death of two longshoremen officials may also be mob-related.
The problem with what the mafia had done, which no organized crime group ever did before, instead of just being an organized crime group, doing murder, doing extortion, doing loan sharking, doing gambling, doing prostitution. They put their tentacles into legitimate society. They controlled the fish market. They controlled restaurants in New York City. They controlled the transportation of our products. They controlled the garment industry. They had judges they put on the bench. They had hospitals they controlled. The docks, the ships, and go on and on.
There is no instrument of hard work, savings, and job creation as effective as the family. The American dream belongs to you.
This is an extremely effectively edited bit as it's going into the credits of the second episode. First of all, I mean, you know... when I was a kid, like, oh, maybe mob related. Like, why don't they just say it is? Okay, well, because nobody's trying to get killed reporting that longshoremen might have been assassinated. But that just made me laugh that it's like the deaths of longshoremen in New Jersey. Totally natural. Nothing to see here. Anyway, today's weather.
Well, yeah, the devil got to him.
Yeah. Lightning strike. What are the odds? They're near water. Pretty good. Then you have Giuliani, like, this is somebody who knows this stuff so well that even if he is in the advanced stages of dementia, he can still do this. And I found myself wishing for the timeline in which he did do this. And he was just like, you know, Uncle Fed, who wouldn't shut up about the mafia, but like he did know a lot about it. And he had several talking heads that were informative. And I just sort of longed for that universe.
Right. No, it's a dual presentation of two really good bits of retro. One is Giuliani still holding up, and two is that kind of like a new wave insistent. You know, you're looking at maybe the deck of the aircraft carrier in Top Gun, but it hasn't kicked into the solo yet, kind of pulsing like bass and synth work. Like I enjoyed that all the way through. I was like, oh, the 80s, right?
Oh, but yeah,
like
that's it was a good point.
But yeah, like I'm
And then there's Reagan sort of having his like, I mean, he's talking about the American family, but okay, like we all understand the dual purpose that that quote serves. But then if you think of just like GOP gangsterism as it's been polymorphously perverting American life in the interim, I don't know. It was just like a really good selection of like a really good clip that was melded in with Giuliani really well. And then they go into the credits. I thought it was great. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, actually that brings up the other point I had, which I think like apart from the fact that in some of their recreations and some of the stuff they're putting on screen to accompany the voiceover, they get a little busy and sometimes a little too literate. Like, and you know, we were worried about his record. And then like, I don't know, like an LP spins across the screen. Like it's sometimes it's a little like that almost.
Yeah,
you know?
Sometimes.
But the thing that I was disappointed about was something that was not at all the fault of this production, which is just that I would like to see like a 10-hour thing on like New York in the 1970s, and just New York, and just all these intersecting kind of events and kind of cultural flows that we absorbed outside of New York, like going back and watching Barney Miller reruns. Like the running plots are about New York's budget and about like strikes and things that we think of as like, you know, historical events and not something that would wind up in a nationwide broadcast. But like, also I was thinking a lot about, right after Trump was elected, everybody started watching this documentary called Hypernormalization, which begins with the financial crisis in New York City and its neoliberal bailout. Right. And like some of that is kind of consonant with Reagan going like, well, you know, the family is going to take care of America because of course, like one of the aims of deregulating the welfare state is it makes you dependent on family, which if you're a woman, that makes you subordinate to men. But like, that's a whole other argument. But like,
oh, is that
there
what does
are
it?
Actually, huh. What's that?
Oh, is that what does it?
Yeah. I mean, just a little bit, but,
yeah, no, I know what you mean.
But like the idea that there really is this ferment of history going through just this, you know, like this one city over, you know, a span of years where you have a complete restructuring of how the city operates financially. And then ultimately like a complete restructuring of how it does its policing. And like, I don't know, that also seemed to be one of the omitted bits, maybe an effective propaganda of like when they're saying, well, how did we not fight the mafia before? It's like, well, cause you were taking money from them.
Yeah.
A huge number of you were, that was part of the problem.
Well, yeah, he kind of, that clip that we just heard, like he sort of comes up to it and then falls back away from it. That it's like, I do have one more clip about the bond between law enforcement and criminals, which like, this is not what this guy is talking about, but you know, like the New York City police force for most of the 19th century was criminals because that's how you caught bad guys, was hire other bad guys who aren't afraid to bust heads. So, you know, there's that whole aspect of it that this doesn't get into, but while I think you're right that I would actually love to see a 10 or 12 part series about New York 1969 to 1981, this series isn't going to be that, and oh, yeah. I'm glad. Like, I was sort of three quarters of the way through the third episode, and I was like, you know, you could stand to pick this up. Like, there's going to be a verdict, and I'm not sure we need everybody reiterating that it was a tense wait during deliberations, because I thought this was four episodes, and I was like, well, what are they going to do? Like, where are they now? Yearbook for episode four? Like the, you know, rise up, like the post Gotti, what are they going to do in episode four? There is no episode four. And I remember being extremely impressed that they got in and out in three episodes, which these things almost never do. And they didn't dick around for 40 minutes right up top explaining to us who fucking Bugsy Siegel is and how, you know, like, the only these people can be made, that, like, if they care, they'll Google it. We're getting right to the point, which very, very rare. Like, this is why most mafia properties, it's like, it's not that I'm not interested. It's that they don't know how to, they don't know how big of bites to take. And this really did.
Yeah, no, and like, all the things that I'm interested in are because I'm the sort of person who will Wikipedia everything that comes into his mind while watching something. And that is not a knock on this. Like I said, I mean, it staved off like complete physical exhaustion for three full episodes, and then I was gone. But up until then, I was like, go on. I mean, and even, you know, like we were saying, I knew a third of it, but I'm still going like, and then what?
Yeah, and even the, I feel like even the stuff that viewers know is stuff that they know, but I mean, this was all 35, 40 years ago, so you're gonna have to learn it again from an adult standpoint. And it's always tempting in these, in series that, you know, glance on New York City at a certain time, like, oh, here's the Trump footage, because there's always the Trump footage, and they have like one snippet.
And then we're done with it. They do, they reprise it. Like, it, you get one and then you get it again. And it is in the same way that, like, you're listening to the Reagan thing and you're like, is that just putting the thumb in the wound and twisting a little? The Trump thing the second time when they do it, and there's like, and it's 12 million or something, like, which is obviously like a payoff amount. You're like, okay, I know what you're doing here.
Yeah. I mean, and, you know, this is a guy who, like, whatever. I think this was in some season of, or some episode of Dirty Money, where, like, during the building strike, Trump properties still were fine.
Yeah. Between that and what was it? One of his Atlantic City casino having, I think, flagging the highest number of this resembles money laundering behavior with whatever, like the FEC, not FEC, but IRS, obviously, but like, like, just that one casino alone doing like 500% of the same suspicious behavior as the one next to it.
Yeah. I mean, you can't not, like, unfortunately, he's part of the fabric of the city at that time. So you kind of have to just, like, have the snippet in there. I forgot, though, that you're right. They recycled it. And that was a little like, okay, you know, you check this off. I'm all set looking at that guy. But these are real tiny quibbles, at least from me. Let me play that last clip and then we can wrap this up.
There's this strange bond that sometimes exists between law enforcement officers and criminals. They both live by codes of honor and respect, more stringent than most normal people. And there's a certain psychological connection there. I heard him on the mic for 600 hours for a 4 or 5 year period. I felt like I knew him. He wasn't supposed to end this way. You know, he's supposed to end up in federal prison.
And then you can write a book together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found that very relatable. There have been certain long interviews that during the transcription of them, I'm like, I think, it, you know, by the end of this, now the subject and I are married in some cultures. Okay. So, I mean, I thought this was really good. They know what they're doing. They stick to what they're doing. They do it well. Sometimes it's a little overproduced, but again, like, my quibbles with it are so teeny, and like, I really don't have any real complaints. I think even people who don't care that much about this subgenre of true crime will find something to like or be compelled by in this. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think, you know, the clip that you played, you know, maybe for some people that's like, well, that's a little kind of copaganda, because, like, tell that shit to Fred Hampton, you know?
Yeah. But,
but, like, there is actually, you know, there's a bit later, you know, kind of at the culmination of the series where there's a scene between, I think, that guy and Castellano. Is that, or is that the scene?
Where, I think that's the scene.
Right. And, like, the rest of that scene, the way it plays out, I think redeems that sentiment. Cause, like, when you hear it, you know, your eye rolls and you're like, come on. Right. But yeah, like, I mean, the emotional sort of interplay of the rest of that tale he tells comes a lot closer to that kind of like morning Ralph, morning Sam,
yes,
kind of like
exactly.
Warner Brothers cartoon kind of vibe. And I bought it. But yeah, I mean, it's worth it. Watch it. You'll enjoy it.
Yep, I agree. Now I'm not sure what I should have them put on the box art. It kept Jeb awake or tell that shit to Fred Hampton. We can think about it later. First, the cold case. Oh boy. Okay. This kept Jeb awake for sure. The Perfect Murder, Season 5, Episode 9, Jump Shot. You can watch this with a gazillion commercials on the ID channel, and you may be able to buy it for $1 on YouTube. Don't do this. Actually, maybe do this. We'll get into it. First, the case file. Oh no, we've lost Jeb. Here we go. From ID's landing page, quote, Hollywood golden boy Gavin Smith, a 20th Century Fox executive and former star UCLA basketball player, goes missing. All of this is sick, by the way. For years, his family and detectives searched tirelessly for answers, but a group of heartless characters holds fast to their secrets. End quote, see? Okay, so we got a call at the Best Evidence tip line. Which is why we're stuck with this one. That's 91975-CRIME for suggestions and or complaints. Our correspondent, whom I'll call Pennsylvania Dutch, actually name-checked the Adrian Shelley episode of The Perfect Murder as worthy of interest, but I hope they'll find this one a suitable substitute. Oh, no. I mean, I don't know where to start, and yet I have to, because you've been incapacitated by joy.
I can do it. I mean, I can say something if you want. This is one of the most demented things I've seen in a while.
Yeah. And people, we watched Caveman for work.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay, well, let's do our breathing and listen to a clip. Spoiler won't help. Which is like intro ID show intro Mad Libs. This is totally over the top. Bears no real relationship to the story as it ends up being told. But let's find out what the voiceover guy thinks we need to know about the case of Gavin Smith.
So where is Gavin Smith? The answer to that question will emerge from a group of heartless characters who are cloaked in secrets and lies.
This is a case of sex, drugs, deceit, and extreme violence. The best Hollywood screenwriter around could not make this case up.
Yes, they could. They easily could. I wish they had.
This is like a 13th season Law and Order episode. There's like not a whole lot happening in here.
No.
I kind of have to take this, like, audience, let me take you through this visually, because it's not a visual medium. When you watch this show, you are immediately bombarded by like six different talking heads who are not identified.
Correct.
And they're all shot in sort of different ways. So at first you see a woman far back in the shot, and then it cuts to a man who you is later identified as Pete Donahue, formerly a New York Daily News transport reporter. And if you look him up, he's got like 800 followers on Twitter. And I don't think he doesn't seem to work for the Daily News. And he hasn't for like 2 years or 3 years. But like, it's the woman in the back. And then it cuts to Pete. And he's like aiming his right shoulder at the camera and leaning over it. And you just sort of expect like a soccer ball to get thrown to him so he can catch it. And then they take the shot and they're like, next kid.
Yeah. Like George Costanza's like boudoir shots, except he has a suit on and he looks really confused. He's also not entirely in focus. And then the green screen is even for investigation discovery. It's like an iPhone 4. It's not good.
The talking heads are not, they're not paying a lot for these folks.
No.
Pete, they're not spending a lot on them there. Like you said, the green screen isn't great for Pete. He also seems like he had a couple of beers in the green room because there's like two different clips where you're like, you couldn't just run that one again. Like,
yeah.
I'm not even sure what two of those words were. And then, but anyway, like, so you get all these people just, you know, and they're telling you just stuff that, and you're not sure how they know it, right? It's basically, it's like having a Wikipedia article read to you like clause by clause by a different voice. So you get through like, you know, whereupon he visits this person and then they go to the, you know, like, and it just slams between them. And then you finally see a name and it's, I'm not making this up. Judge Patricia DeMango, host of Hot Bench. And like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do with that.
I mean, you did it. I think here's some other visual delights, if I may. They go to interview a film executive. We have a clip for that, but she has a reserved sign on her desk. I don't get it. A woman who comes to report to another detective, like this is an employee of the LA Sheriff's Office, comes to report that some key information has come in on the tip line, wearing a crop top, like visible midriff. At the cop shop, okay. The bones, quote,
right.
Look like that they find in Angeles National Park look like someone barely, like they lay one of those front door cardboard skeletons on the ground and like kicked some dirt over it. Not a lot, some. They could have found a reenactor who looked less like actual Gavin Smith, but that person would have had to have been another race and a lady.
Before they find the bleached skeleton, and it's actually, it, you know, like you may not living in the suburbs, you can get like the bone things and you lay them in like your front flower bed so it looks like some of a skeleton is surfacing.
Yeah. Oh, no, people yeah. go bonkers with that here too. They just okay. use like the window box. But yeah, no, I know what you yeah. mean.
But the voiceover for that is, you know, it's, I can't remember how many miles away, but it's like 100 or so miles away, a passing motorist is about to get the shock of a lifetime. And it cuts to a guy in a white t-shirt staggering through the woods, drinking a bottled water. And that's what he finds, the bones. And you're like, I don't know if you know this, but that's not a car. That's a water bottle.
Is it me or was that supposed to be a beer and he was about to post up at that tree to take a piss?
Yeah, I mean, it really did, like,
do the thing, then. Oh, my God. And, I mean, oh, Jesus, like, this goes through bad and good and bad and good so many times that, I mean, this was, except for the commercials, this was, like, extremely enjoyable to me, which is not good. Like, this is horrible what happened to this guy. But
right.
the reenactments are both so committed and so, I don't know. Well, they're enthusiastic, I guess.
It's like the thing I was trying, okay, because all these people act like they've never met each other before. And in some cases, they may not have met other people before.
Yeah.
Like there is a degree of physical acting in this that like, I think I sent you like a one paragraph description of three wordless seconds. Like I'm like engrossed by like, watch this with the sound off. Like if you watch it as is, like try to get with the sound off. It can be a completely different experience, but like,
even in snippets where like there is no sound and it's only on screen for not even a full second, the acting is completely committed. Like this guy, they're trying to figure out if Gavin Smith disappeared because of something to do with opioid abuse thanks to chronic pain. So first of all, his acting wrenching his back when that Rolly case is clearly empty. Amazing.
Yes.
But
it's like he's going to spill like a brush and a bucket and like a mop on the front of his car, you know, just, oh, how many times has this happened to you? You need to go get opioids.
Oh God. Yes. And then he just sort of like creaks into the bedroom that he's sharing at this woman's house. And like, they're obviously in this, you know, Airbnb in Calabasas. Fine. With the sequin pillow that all the Airbnbs have. The snippet I'm talking about is him draining a beer by turning it literally like upright, upside down. And then only the bottle is green and the rest of the shot is black and white. This will be in the visual aids at Blotter Presents on Twitter. Lucky you guys. I clipped all of this stuff, including the belly shirt.
It's like if you could see an ad for medicated beer. Right? Yeah. Like the beer immediately targets your pain zone. And like you see the green of the bottle disperse through the body.
It's like those creepy Crime 360 like 3D renderings of how COVID is transmitted. Except green.
Right.
And beery. And crimey. All right. I think we need to talk about the detectives.
Wait, I thought of the other half of my analogy that I went for and I lost track of. Right. The acting in it, it's sort of like if you could get out of minimum security prison 6 months early if you took part in a drama program.
I mean, is it like that or is it that? Because I can't prove it isn't that.
Like a lot of the locations they're shooting could be on the grounds of the penitentiary. I don't know.
Yeah, that's true.
That could be an awfully nice pillow
for the penitentiary. Right. You reminded me that I actually never used the Giuliani Botox analogy. Should I take a run at it or let it die?
Sure.
Okay, here's the thing. Botox is botulism, right? So if it's used off-label correctly for one thing, it's good.
Yes.
Like for migraine. And then for everything else, it's botulism.
Right.
Giuliani.
Right. So Giuliani and the mafia is like botulinum or whatever. Yeah. No, I see. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That works.
Okay. Great. So back to things that don't really work, which is this acting. I was saying to you earlier that the dude in these scenes takes long enough pauses that it's like almost naturalistic in his responses. But I do get the feeling that he actually yelled line between like that's what the pause is for, that he yelled line and it got cut out. Here's just one example. And then his scene partner seems to think she's in the Maltese something or other. I don't know. Here's clip 7.
Well, the bank and phone company have been alerted.
Now what?
It's Hollywood, baby. Let's go to the studio.
Good idea.
Is it? I have a couple other good ideas.
They were deleted Stella scenes from Adler. this is a screenwriter repurposing scenes that didn't get used for the movie 15 Minutes.
I mean, wait, which one is that? I'm sorry.
I think it's like Ed Burns and De Niro.
Oh, yeah.
Or somebody else. But it's a real, like, we're real cops, but we're on the set of whatever. Or maybe that was a Harrison Ford thing. I don't know. This is back when Kelsey Grammer could still be in a movie screaming about how if it bleeds, it leads. So
okay.
Maybe that's
wait, are you talking about the one with Harrison Ford had an earring and then his partner was what's his nuts from that movie where Lily Sobieski got knee cancer?
Wait, was that Aaron Eckhart? Was that
him? No, or, Jesus no. Christ.
Not Aaron Eckhart. No, the guy who's in
Hartnett.
Thank you. There, you know, Hartnett, Eckhart, they're really close.
They're really not.
Oh, one God. Of the guy was one of them was Two-Face and the other one was I think X or Sever. No, I'm just bleeding movies at this point.
Wow.
Slevin. It was Slevin, right?
Yes.
Was it Hartnett Slevin?
Yes, Hartnett was Slevin, but was Harrison Ford in that or was that a different joint?
I have no idea.
Oh my God. I'm glad we've gone so far off. This is like when Daffy Duck is like getting erased during the cartoon. This is not good. I'm not really sure how to bring it back online, frankly, so I'm going to play another clip. Everybody enjoy what would happen if Seth Green and Jimmy Cagney had a kid.
Look familiar?
No.
Then why is this car in your storage facility?
How would I know? I'm in jail.
Maybe your wife knows him.
You mean the wife who's divorcing me? The one who hasn't talked to me in years? That wife?
Maybe you caught him together. Decided to take matters into your own hands.
Who cares? Guys, I'm done. Take me back to my cell. I know my rights.
Who cares, indeed? I can't.
That was right after the woman cop is like, I'm going to get him out of his comfort zone. I'm going to get an order from the DA and bring him from prison to us. And it's like, you're going to spook him by giving him a field trip? Like,
cut to obviously prison. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I mean, this is not good, but the thing is that having watched this and laughed at it and cut clips from it and like frame by framed it to get hilarious acting shots from it for everyone's delectation in the visual aids, I feel like I have a pretty good handle on the timeline of the case.
Yeah.
So, okay. Perfect murderer. I guess I see you. I don't want to keep seeing you, but okay.
I could see like DVRing the whole season of this and just keeping them for days when you're hungover or sick. Because they are, I mean, there's something obviously troubling about how funny it is because, I mean, obviously a horrible thing happened to a person.
Yeah.
But like you don't want to laugh at it, but then you get to the very end and one of your talking heads is supposed to put like the eponymous capper on this thing.
Uh-huh.
And she says something to the effect of, well, if he hadn't kept a car full of blood evidence and a license plate screw with fingerprint evidence on it in a storage locker tied to him, John Creech would have gotten away with the perfect murder. And you're like, yeah, notwithstanding losing to the Allies, the Axis would have won World War II. Like, what's your point?
Yeah.
It's not perfect.
You're exactly right. That it's like, with the exception of getting caught, this was the perfect murder. Like, can we maybe reframe what we mean by perfect then? Because I don't think we agree. I also feel bad laughing at this, but this is like the Ploop incident from a few episodes ago. Listeners will remember that day, you know, one of the prom mom cases that we were covering for a show very much like this, that Foley artist was perhaps overly committed to making sure we knew what it would sound like if someone gave birth in a toilet. Didn't work out.
Yeah. I remember listening to that. I remember having to, I had to pause weed whacking. That's not a euphemism. I was doing yard work. Anyway.
I mean, yeah. So look, what happened to Gavin Smith is terrible. And it was reenacted in this unbelievably hilarious, like the fatal set to is also acted like this Seth Green, Jimmy Cagney guy is obliged to like come upon him and his estranged wife in flagrante and then attack Gavin Smith. But what he's doing is banging on the roof of the car in an extremely cartoonish way as though they're like Spider-Man up on the top of the car. And then that's going to make them like fall off and then he can scoop them up. I don't understand what the blocking was there.
And then he winds up punching him and there are these really short, like only a few inches long, rapid punches. And you see him briefly just like, and it looked like the action sequences from the trailer for Italian Spider-Man. It's just, it was like the same amount of fury. And I was expecting like one of them to just light up while it's going.
There's also really no reason that, Gavin Smith couldn't, having been a college hoops guy, have just placed a large palm on the skull of this individual and held him while the guy was Italian Spider-Manning. But, you know, like the fact that we're contemplating this and not, you know, the fragility of life doesn't speak well of the perfect murder. But like I said, now I know the case. So
yeah. Yeah. Notwithstanding the writing, the acting, the set decoration, the music and the voiceover, this is probably a perfect TV show.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, The Perfect Murder, it's on the ID Go app, and go forth. Best of luck to you all. We did it.
We made it.
In local news today, bees.
Nope.
Is there anything you'd like to plug for the listeners, Jeb?
Well, you may not have heard it, but I do a podcast called Quaid in Full with a woman named Sarah D. Bunting. We are watching every Dennis Quaid movie in a row. I joined for the second season, and we're getting to the stuff where people are going to start to recognize the movies. We're recording Jaws 3 shortly, and then there's just going to be a whole bunch of like classic Quaid stuff that you know. So come check it out, and especially like we've done a couple of movies that are, you know, almost completely out of print, really difficult to find, that are kind of, you know, surprising if still misgiven. And that's kind of fun to check out. So.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, a double bill for episode 153, Kevin Flynn on Anne Rule's Sleeping with Danger. That's not a bit. It's actually a thing. And Jessica Lee's on The Last Narc. Also not a bit. It got re-undisappeared by Amazon Prime. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews and blotter briefs. Briefs. So sign up today. My guest has been Jeb Lund, and he's on Twitter at Mobute. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.